I've always been a fan of the Hick from French Lick, if you guys are familiar with who that is. Does anybody know who that is? Oh. Who is it? Larry Bird, that's right, the Hick from French Lick. Yeah, you know, growing up, you know, I was from Indiana. A lot of us were fans of Bird. Got a few more Hoosiers in the house this morning. So we one of the things that I found out later, though, in life about Bird was that he's a huge trash talker. I did not know that growing up. I was just a kid. I didn't know how much of a trash talker he was. You know, and trash talk, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's when, you know, players are jawing at each other. They're telling each other what they're going to do, how they're going to beat the other, the opponent, how they're going to win the game. And there are lots of stories about Larry Bird trash talking. One of the most common stories that you'll hear if you get on the internet is how Larry would go up to either the coach or the opposing team and he'd say, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go catch it over in the corner and I'm going to hit a three and win the game. And then he would do it. The very thing that he said he was going to. Sometimes they would listen to him and they'd go over there and actually try to guard him. And the worst they'd do, or the best they'd do, is foul him and he'd hit the free throws. But I mean, that's just kind of, he was a legend for doing this. One of the stories Magic Johnson tells is that he told the Lakers and he told the coach that he was going to go over to the corner and hit a three and win the game. And in the course of the play that they'd drawn up, there was a switch. And so Magic was racing over to the corner to kind of guard him. And he said that Larry was saying, I don't know why you're coming. And he shot it. And then when he hit it, he said, you came all that way for nothing. Now that's the kind of guy I was. Now what's the purpose of trash talk? Trash talk is not only something that people have fun with. I mean, Larry always said that he just had fun, like talking it up. It's also, it can be used to kind of intimidate people, right? Because here's the thing about basketball. If you're not confident when you're shooting, you're going to miss. So if you can get into somebody's head, make them a little less confident, you're actually improving the chances of winning the game. And that is something I'm sure Larry did. Now, that's what happens on the court. And you don't, like I, growing up, never heard what was going on. But there's also a version of trash talk that happens in public. You've seen these boxing press conferences? Yeah, those are kind of interesting. Why would they give boxers this platform where they can just trash talk each other? Well, that builds the hype for the fight. The same people that are watching the press conference are wanting to go now watch the fight. They want to see what happens. So it like builds the desire to see it, the excitement. So the passage that we're looking at this morning, it just kind of sounds like trash talk. Now, I know that might sound a little too beneath God to do, but the fact is he's telling people what he's going to do, and then he does it. So there are some differences, of course. I mean, on the one hand, these are not two equal opponents. No, there's no real comparison between the two. And the one who is so far beneath the other one, the one who doesn't even deserve to be in the same sentence as God, he's done most of the talking up to this point. He's been the one that the world has heard up to the point of this oracle here. So unlike most press conferences where you hear two sides, you really only hear God's response at this point. The other guy's already talked. Now we're getting the other side. And it's really God responding to this absurdity. So the guy that he's talking to or about has these delusions of grandeur, and he's setting things straight. So he's not doing it really, though, to demoralize the individual he's talking about, because this is actually written for Israel. It's written for a different audience. So he's not trying to intimidate the king of Babylon, because, as we'll see, he stands for something more than just one person. But he's trying to help the people that have heard this other intimidating trash talk, the Israelites who have heard these kings talk about how powerful they are. He's trying to give his people the real picture of what's really going on. So the language may sound a little harsh. But what we need to understand is we need to put this conversation in perspective, in context. God is trying to help us see exactly how ridiculous these pretentious kings have been. And sometimes it takes a bit of ridiculous to get that across. So what we have here is a parodied funeral. It's a sarcastic eulogy. And he's telling his people, God's telling his people, this is what you're going to tell the king of Babylon when he goes the way of all things. Now, I'm saying this is the king of Babylon, but just like we saw last week, the city of Babylon represented more than just Babylon. So does this king. For one, the people that conquered Babylon all wanted to be known as the king of Babylon. It was a title that they all longed to have. So it stands for something more than just the king of Babylon. So just as the Bible actually begins with Babylonian empires at the beginning, and then it ends in the same way. You have the Tower of Babel or Babylon, and then you end with Babylon the Great. We have this singular opponent who really is wanting to be like God. Remember that from the beginning as well. Adam and Eve wanted to be like God. And then we have the man of lawlessness that Paul mentions, who says that he is going to be, or he's going to proclaim himself to be God. There's always been this kind of opposition with God. Always been puny humans wanting to be like him. And so the kind of opposition we see, like you could see in 2 Thessalonians with the man of lawlessness, could be referred to as Antichrist, opposing Christ. That's the way the term is used. That's what John uses the term for in his letters. He's the only one to use it in the New Testament. He lets us know that the spirit of Antichrist is already at work in the world. And so this person here who's opposing God, now that his Messiah has come, is opposing Christ. It's the same idea. So he's an Antichrist. Now, we'll admit, we'll all acknowledge that funerals aren't funny. So not trying to belittle that. But what we need to do is think for a second about a funeral for Sauron from Lord of the Rings. Or the Emperor from Star Wars. Or Voldemort. Like, what would that kind of be like? There would be no tears shed for, say, the Emperor. Even twice now that we have to go through that. People, even some of Voldemort's followers were breathing a sigh of relief when he was gone. So we need to see this more like an imagined funeral for Hitler put on by the survivors of the Holocaust. That's what we're looking at this morning. And that deserves to be sardonic. It deserves to be said in this kind of sarcastic way. So let's look at this funeral for an Antichrist. That's how I'm going to break it down. We'll see the arrangements for the funeral in the first four verses. Then we'll get a glimpse of the funeral services in verses 4 through 11. And then there's a sort of obituary there in verses 12 through 21. And some parting words in the last two verses. So you can turn to Isaiah 14 if you're not already there. Again, it's on page 541 in the Bible there. In the pew, we're going to look at these, the arrangements, services, obituary, and parting words for this funeral for an Antichrist. And we'll start with the arrangements. So verses 1 and 2, they're really pointing back to the last chapter. The word 4 tells us that it's explaining something from that last chapter. The second half of verse 22 of chapter 13 talks about how the time is close at hand and the days will not be prolonged. So this promised day of the Lord for Babylon, it's close at hand. It's not some far-off reality. The Lord who's going to bring it about, who's sovereign over all that goes on, he is close at hand, just physically, but also it's not long from his eternal standpoint when he's going to bring this about. So these first two verses then are explaining why God's going to do this. Why is he going to do this to Babylon? It has to do with his compassion on his people. He refers to his people here, though, as Jacob and Israel. And remember, at the time that this was written, Jacob's family is divided into two kingdoms, northern and the southern. And so the Lord's speaking to a time when that's going to be, that this people is going to be reunited, just like they were when God rescued them from Egypt and made them his people. So it was back in the Exodus that God first showed his compassion on Jacob's family. And it's when he chose them. So there's a sense in which God had, he'd promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he was going to choose their descendants. He'd already really chosen them. But Moses says multiple times in Deuteronomy that when he freed them, rescued them from Egypt, he was choosing Israel at that time. So Deuteronomy 7 puts it this way. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession. Out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth, it was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath he swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So God chose Israel to be his people, just as he had chosen Abraham. Nehemiah 9:7 says, you are the Lord, the God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. So God then chose Isaac and not Ishmael. He chose Jacob and not Esau. And he had chosen Jacob's descendants. But again, when he rescued them from Egypt, it was like choosing them again. And here Isaiah is saying that after Israel's exile, God is going to do it again. He's going to choose Israel again. So just like God had rescued Israel from their slavery in Egypt, this new exile, this new slavery really, that was going to take place, was going to require a rescue. And when God did that, he would be choosing his people again. Then after the exodus from Egypt, God promised to give his people rest in the promised land. And here he's promising the same thing, rest back in their land. And the exodus also had sojourners that accompanied the people. Exodus 12:38 talks about that mixed multitude. And here you have the same thing. Sojourners going with Israel during the second Exodus. Joining the people of God. Sounds a lot like Rahab or Caleb, who became part of God's people when they were from other countries. And it's a theme we've seen in Isaiah. There is a future not just for Israel, but for the nations that Isaiah keeps coming up. There's doom spelled out for the empires of this world, but it's also that doom that actually is the greatest hope for the nations. Because God is, when he puts an end to these empires, he is also opening up the way for the Gentiles. And that's what Daniel describes, right? With that rock that arrives and crushes the feet of the tower, that statue. That rock is Christ, who's going to put an end to the kingdoms. So the very rock that is the downfall of these empires is also the means by which us nations are grafted into God's people. And so even as Isaiah has turned now in these chapters to talk about the nations, and it's very much about judgment, there's this periodic undercurrent of hope for the nations that keeps popping up. Now, it's not just hope, though, that happens to the nations. And so in verse 2, you see the other side of this story for what happens to the nations. God's people, rather, they've constantly been mistreated by the nations, by these larger nations. And God's saying, one day that's not going to be the case. Everything is going to be turned around. The God who conquered the Canaanites for his people at the first Exodus is going to conquer the world for his people at the second Exodus. So these nations are going to return the people to their land, is what it says. And then Isaiah uses language from the conquest. Only instead of referring to the possession of land, he refers to the possession of the nations, possessing them as male and female slaves in the Lord's land. So the roles are going to be reversed. One day, in the pretty close future here for Israel, they were going to be slaves in Babylon. But that was going to change. And so just as the empires took them captive, they would take these nations captive. Sounds a lot like Daniel 7, that refers to the saints taking possession of the kingdom that had been ripped away from those four other kingdoms, those four beasts. And then using the language of Israel's oppression in Egypt and language from the creation blessing, you have the Lord promising his people that they will rule over Babylon, over those that have oppressed him, the kingdoms of this earth. And we know that's accomplished through reigning with Christ one day. So this final rest, it's mentioned again in verse 3, again with language from slavery in Egypt, the mistreatment there. It's at this time when God gives them rest that the Lord's going to say, or Lord tells them to take up what's referred to as a taunt. That word describes a comparison in some way, like a proverb or a parable. It's something figurative. And so we have here a poem that's a lament. The form of it is a funeral lament. It's like David cries for Saul and Jonathan at the first chapter of 2 Samuel. He mourns for them. But there's no mourning that's actually happening here. This is very much not genuine sorrow. It's a parody of a funeral lament. So, in the wake of this promise to one day hand over the empires of this world to God's people, and as the nations are grafted in, there's going to be a celebration when that happens of the end of the leader of the world, or the leaders of the world. They're going to celebrate the end of the one who opposed God with this sarcastic eulogy. So this is a kind of form of pre-planning, right, for a funeral that hasn't occurred yet. Making arrangements in the form of this funeral eulogy. And as they do that, it's of course not to honor this great king like a eulogy normally does, right? A eulogy is usually to honor somebody who's passed away. It's to celebrate a life. This is clearly to dishonor this tyrannical opponent of God. It's to celebrate his death. So it's very odd funeral arrangements that you see here. It's meant to be that way. It's figurative. But again, it makes sense. If you're having a funeral for Voldemort, this is the kind of funeral you'd have. Some people don't deserve honor in death. Some people don't deserve anyone to really be sad that they're gone. This is the individual that we're talking about, somebody who is the epitome of opposition to God. So when this song is sung, it describes these funeral services. And I mean that there's two services that it describes. There's one that happens with the people on earth as they respond to this man's death. And then you have one that describes the funeral happening down below in the grave. So when David mourned for Saul and Jonathan, he said, "How the mighty have fallen." And you have a similar kind of terminology here in verse 4. "How the oppressed have ceased. The insolent fury ceased." It's a sarcastic version of it, celebrating the fact that this oppressor is gone. And then the symbols of his oppression, his staff and his scepter, they're described as being broken by the Lord in verse 5. That's what the king had used to persecute peoples in verse 6. He beat them, it describes him as doing, beating them mercilessly and never stopping. That's what it pictures here. But now he's dead. And verse 7 says, now there's finally peace and quiet. It's not quiet long, though, because immediately it has the world, the whole earth breaks forth into singing. It's a ringing cry. It's a celebratory song that just kind of bursts out when he's gone. Even the trees are celebrating, it says. In verse 8, the cypresses and the cedars of Lebanon are celebrating. So it's common for Babylonian or for Mesopotamian kings to go into Lebanon's forest and to get timber to build all their royal constructions, but the woodcutters aren't going to be coming anymore now that he's dead. So it's a horrifying funeral. No one wants a funeral like this, right? Nobody wants people to celebrate when you're gone. You want the comfort of knowing that somebody is going to be sad. You don't want to make people sad, but you want to know that people will miss you. Well, this king is not going to be missed. It's only going to be celebrated when he breathes his last. So that's the service happening above. And then the Lord gives us a picture of what's happening below. Now, this is not giving us a picture of what really happens after death. This, again, is figurative language. But he's giving us a picture of what it would be like, according to their pagan conceptions, the way that the Babylonians would think of the afterlife is the picture he's giving. What would it be like when this king arrived in Sheol? So you have the leaders of the earth, and many of these leaders had been sent to this place by this king. That's the idea. Now this king shows up, and on his arrival in the afterlife, according to the pagan view, you have this shadowy world where people basically are just in a kind of reflective position that they were in. So you have these kings, they're like they were up when they were still alive. They're sitting on thrones, only they're kind of in this sleepy, shadowy existence. And so they're sitting on these thrones. And when the king arrives, these shadowy figures kind of wake up. And they, again, they're there, many of them, because on the battlefield, they've been sent to this place. So they get up, and it looks like they're going to give homage. By getting up off their thrones, it looks like they're going to give homage to this king who's just arrived. Only it's not honor that they give him. They begin to say in verse 10, you too have become as weak as we. You become like us. It's like the word too there is giving this emphatic response. Even you? They're mocking him. They're saying, you mean you die just like we do? You're mortal? You're no better than us, even though in life you made us, you wanted us to think that you were better than us. You were no better than us. And then they go on to compare or contrast his living arrangements from the living arrangements he had when he was living alive and his digs now. So they say, you know, you were so high, but you've been brought low. You can't even hear your royal harps at this distance. You can't even hear the music that you used to play. And now instead of the comfy Babylonian beds that you had and those expensive blankets, you get maggots for a bed and worms for your covers. So they're just mocking him as he comes in. So what an exit and what an entrance. What a greeting. He leaves this earth, and as he leaves, it's not to the sound of people mourning. It's to party, a party going on. And as he arrives in the underworld, where he thinks he's going to be at least honored by these other kings that he's conquered, they make fun of him. They make fun of his earthly pretensions. You know, you thought you were so great. Look at you now. You're just like us. We're all dead. Now, when a person dies, we know usually there's an obituary written for them. This brief description about the person often includes the loved ones they're survived by. It sometimes mentions accomplishments. And also an obituary goes out to announce to people that this person has passed away. So it often gives these funeral arrangements, tells you what's going to happen, where the person's going to be buried. So we have kind of an obituary here in verses 12 through 21. Doesn't list the accomplishments, just the ambitions, because he never accomplishes what he was ambitiously trying to. Tells us where he's going to be laid to rest. It tells us who he's going to be survived by. But again, this is not to honor him. This is trying to put on display the dishonor that he deserves. Instead of being memorialized for all time, they're going to have his memory blotted out. Now, the first thing I want to mention is the elephant in the room with verse 12, at least, right? So older English translations like the King James and even earlier, they chose to transliterate the Latin translation of one of these words, which is Lucifer. So the Hebrew word behind that just means shining one. The Latin translation and the Greek translation just means something like bringer of light. So it's reference to the morning star, which is not actually a star, but a planet that is still light in the morning. So some of the church fathers, like Augustine or Jerome or Origen, they believed that this was a reference to Satan. Now, they also were very prone to allegorize things, just to be clear. When the reformers came along, they did not see the connection. So they didn't think that this was talking about Satan. And since the Reformation, there has been a steady flow of scholars and commentators who do not see Satan here. So you have those that wrote the Geneva Study Bible notes in the 1500s said, nope, not Satan. You have Matthew Poole and John Trapp from the 1600s, Adam Clark in the early 1800s, Franz Delitzsch in the late 1800s. And these are just the ones that I've come across. This is not an exhaustive list. And then you have many, many modern scholars, including the very, very conservative scholar Edward Young, writing in the 60s. And he points something very helpful out in terms of identifying this person. He says that inasmuch then as this passage describes a king's downfall and removal from the scene, it cannot apply to Satan. See, here's the thing. Satan fell, that's true. But Satan is still, according to 1 Peter, roaming around seeking someone to devour. That's not what this king is doing. This king's done. He's in the grave. He has no authority whatsoever. That is not true of Satan's fall. It's true of this individual's fall. So I realize for some who have thought that this was talking about Satan, because that is an interpretation that's still out there, it can seem unnerving to realize that what little we know of Satan's fall, we actually know even less. So if that's concerning to you, I don't mind talking to you about it afterwards. But this is the king of Babylon. This is a human, very clearly by all of it. And the way that this is recorded, it reminded one of the commentators, and it jumps out at me now that I've seen this poem. It reminds us of a poem named about Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. He was inspired by seeing a statue of the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II. And so he, in his version of what happened, he has a traveler come across this broken down statue in the desert. It's two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand there with the head lying on the sand. So you have just legs, and then next to it a head kind of covered, half covered by the sand. And the poem ends by reading the message on the statue. It says, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." It's a wonderfully impressive boast. And given the sands of time, it's a joke. Here he's saying, "Look at all I've done." And now that the statue's still standing, it's not quite standing. His head's over here and he just has legs. And all around him is empty. Everything else that was there is gone. This is the kind of reversal that's happening here. Only it's even greater for this Antichrist, this opposer of God. So the Lord begins at verse 12 with this comparison between the morning star and this king. And it also seems like this may be pointing to some of these pagan myths that describe a coup in the pantheon. You have this god, this upstart who tries to take over the ruling god. And it's kind of the picture that you get from this. So this king is like this morning star. You know, as much as it's this bright object in the early morning, it's going to be overtaken by the sun every day. He didn't have a prayer. He was doomed to fall from the start. And then the second half sounds like a lumberjack being felled himself. You know, he was the one going down, cutting down trees, and now he's been cut down. That wasn't his ambition. Like Adam and Eve in the garden, he wanted to be like God. And this ambition in verses 12 and following, it's described, again, from a pagan perspective. Now, it's not a Babylonian paganism that you find here, because Israel hadn't been to Babylon yet. So Isaiah and the Lord is using imagery from the Canaanite version of paganism. And so the king is pictured as saying, "I will ascend to heaven above the stars of El. I will set my throne on high." Now the Hebrew word translated God there is correctly translated, but it's not Elohim. It's a word that is not only a word for God, but also the name of the chief god in the Canaanite pantheon. And then it says, he says, "I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of Zaphon." Now, Zaphon, it's translated the north because it can be used that way, but Zaphon is actually a mountain. It's actually the mountain where the Canaanites thought the gods assembled, just like the Greek gods were thought to assemble on Mount Olympus. And then he says in verse 14, "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High." Again, Baal's associated with the clouds, and the Most High is a designation that could be applied to El in the Canaanites. So here you have this king imagining he's going to displace the gods. As far as he knew, he imagined himself as sitting on El's throne, coming with the clouds like Baal, and into the assembly of the gods to take his seat among them like he's their equal. He's got these high, high ambitions, and he is brought very low, to the lowest. I think the ESV does a great job of maintaining this play on words found in verses 13 and 15. So the king, he's thinking he's going to sit in the far reaches of Mount Zaphon, and he's brought to the far reaches of the pit, which is a synonym for the grave or Sheol. Verses 16 and 17 then describe the reactions of the people that came across his body. So they're staring at this body and they think, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go? It's a very good description of kings like Nebuchadnezzar, who went through city after city and imprisoned people and did not let them go back home. He took them to Babylon. But here's his body. Now, normally what happens is what's described in verse 18. When a king dies, they usually are, their bodies are taken to these mausoleums, these massive tombs that house their body and memorialize this king's greatness. But that's not what happens to this body. It's as though he died in battle. And his body is thrown actually in the opposite direction of where he thought he was going to be buried. He's treated like a diseased branch on a tree that people prune and then just throw away. Now, previously he was decked out in this royal clothing. Well, now his clothing are the other dead bodies that have fallen and covered him. He's in this common grave, this unmarked grave that ends up being trampled underfoot because no one even knows it's there. Then verse 20 continues this theme that he's not going to be remembered. And it describes him just like Stalin, we know, from Russia, who killed his people for his own ambitions. This king is described as killing his people, destroying his land for the sake of his ambitions. And then you have a curse that closes out verse 20, where the people want to deny the memory of him. They say, may the offspring of evildoers never more be named. They're wanting to blot out his memory, which usually takes place by eradicating a king's sons. That's what happens when one dynasty ends and another begins. They would execute the sons, and that's what verse 21 calls for. Putting an end to the dynasty, making it so that this king, who now you can see, he represents more than just himself. He represents this dynasty of rulers. And that dynasty has to come to an end so there can be no more sons. There can be no more sons who could survive and keep trying to possess the earth, who would keep setting up these garrison cities. So this man, in the end, is not going to be remembered. That's the idea. And he's going to be survived by no one. No graveside service for him. Sands of time, they swallow him up just like they did for Ozymandias. Each and every Antichrist, each and every leader who pursues their own kingdom is doing that in opposition to Christ, no matter if they claim to be a Christian or not, from Putin to Nebuchadnezzar. And they end the same way. So we'd do well to heed these parting words at this funeral here in the last two verses. He gives his farewell. The Lord does this not just for the king of Babylon, though. He's now, with an exclamation point, talking to all of Babylon. He says things like, declares the Lord, and twice declares the Lord of hosts. He's being very clear. What is being said right now is coming from the Lord, the one who is in charge of every army that exists. So even though the sons of the king of Babylon won't rise, according to verse 21, the Lord is going to rise. He'll rise up against them, and not only will he cut off the king's line, but he is going to put an end to this empire. It's just like Johnny Cash sings. You can run for a long time, but sooner or later, God will cut you down. It says here that he will cut off from Babylon name and remnant, descendants and posterity. The Hebrew here is alliterated. It's kind of like kith and kin. It's saying every possible memory is going to be taken away as this kingdom, this empire is destroyed. In the end, these desert animals are going to be all that possesses the land. It's going to be a place with swampy pools where only the kind of animals that can eke out this meager life can exist. God says he's going to take his broom of destruction and sweep Babylon right out of history. Now, that's some trash talk. I mean, again, this is God saying what's going to happen even before Babylon's in charge. He's saying, I'm going to take the shot from the corner, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. I'm going to win the game. There's no question. And he's not saying that for the king. He's telling the people, look, you've heard a lot of trash talk. You've heard and seen these kingdoms. They've mistreated you. And they're thinking they're star players on the bench. He's not on the bench. It's all going according to plan. He's letting them know right now, here's what's going to happen. And it happens. It's going to happen. It has happened with many of these kings, and it's going to happen. Only this is not a game. It's real life. So the stakes are so much higher. It's life or death. But the promise is that the people who look like they're in charge now are not going to be in charge forever. So they can oppose God's people all they want, but they don't get the last say. It's the true king who's really in charge. And the amazing thing is how different the true king is from this king. I mean, he's the exact opposite of this mere mortal. The true king is not somebody who presumed an equality with God. He is equal with God. Unlike this king who thought he could ascend to heaven, the true king is the one who descended from heaven. This Babylonian lord, he's the height of human hubris here. The true king puts on display the greatest expression of humility. He humbled himself. He moved in the opposite direction that this king was going in. You know, you have a human trying to become a god. We have God becoming a man. And he humbled himself even more by giving up his life and experiencing the utter shame of crucifixion while this king's trying to grab the greatest possible glory. And in the end, he couldn't get it. He wasn't going to be exalted. He couldn't exalt himself. He was going to be in the lowest of the low. He died. His body was corrupted in the grave. But that is not true of the true king. The wording of Psalm 16:10, his father would not abandon his soul to Sheol or let his Holy One see corruption. He raised him from the dead. And far from taking away his name, far from reducing him to the lowest, he exalted him to the highest. He highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. And he said he was going to do that hundreds of years before, and then he did it. So we can be confident that the rest of his promises are going to be true as well. Now, in the end, there are only two teams. So either you follow Christ or you oppose him. That is what Jesus said in Matthew 12:30. Whoever is not with me is against me. There is no neutral. You can't say, you know, I'm just feeling it out. I'm just trying to decide, you know, if I'm pro-Jesus or not. If you're not pro-Jesus, if you're not on Jesus' side, you are against him. So the question in reading such a shocking poem is, whose side are you on? So if you're on Christ's team, then by faith in him, you share in those promises in the first two verses. But if you're on the Antichrist team, if you're a part of the opposition, you share in the last two verses of this section. So that's the question. Whose team are you on? Now is the time to answer that question. And then as we consider that, we also want to think about personal ambition, right? Ambition is something that's very often viewed as a virtue, and we understand why. I mean, there's nothing virtuous about being a bump on a log. It's not virtuous, but very often the ambitions that we have prove to be very selfish. We're not wanting to do great things for others. We're going to do them for ourselves. For our greatness, for our name. We want people to know us. But the truth, I think, was put well by C.T. Studd, a missionary, who said, only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. I mean, the sands of time and death are going to erase every other pursuit, every other thing you attempt to do. Even the good that we can try to spin as being done for Jesus. And this is something that pastors especially, we struggle with, because it's so easy to say, I want to do great things for Jesus. And we end up trying to baptize our ambitions. Try to get famous through Christian service. That makes no sense. But it's a temptation. And yet, this kind of a passage tells us that is not what we want. So are you trying to be somebody? Or are you busy living for the only somebody who's worth praising? One of the ways that we continually remind ourselves to take our eyes off of us and to put them on the one who made us, who saved us, who called us, who's coming back for us, one of the ways we do that is through the Lord's Supper. And that's what we're going to participate in. And when we do that, we want to be very clear, not just to our visitors, but to the members of our church family. We want everyone to understand what we're doing when we do this. So we explain it every time. This is not a practice that is just for anybody who's a Christian who maybe from time to time gathers with other Christians. This is a practice that Jesus established for local churches that have committed, groups of believers that have committed to each other. And so it relates to the church family. It's done for people who have joined together in obedience to Christ. We join together through baptism. And I know that some have been baptized elsewhere, but we bring you in a similar way by committing to you through our membership process. But it's this group that has been affirmed, their faith has been affirmed by baptism, that is reaffirmed through the Lord's Supper. So that's what we're doing. By eating and drinking together, we're reaffirming our faith for each other. We're, by permitting each other to all participate, we're saying, yes, we still believe that your profession is true. And we're saying that to one another. So that's why it's done for church families who know each other, know their professions. But we do allow visitors to participate with us. So if you're a baptized member of another church and you are that you normally attend and you're with us today, then you can participate. But if that's not true and you'd like to learn more about what I'm talking about, I'd love to talk to you afterwards. Just let things pass by and we can talk afterwards. So would the men come forward to administer the Lord's Supper? As you wait, we need to consider if you are turning from sin, if you are reflecting this commitment you have, not just to us, but to Christ. So consider that, confess your sin, and then join us and celebrate, and wait until after we read Scripture before you participate. So join me in a word of prayer. Father, again, we are so thankful that you tell us the end before it happens. With all the different things in this world that people can be afraid of. I mean, from AI to wars to other things, that we know what's going to happen. You've told us. We can have confidence. The same one who's been in charge throughout history is going to be in charge of how it ends. Help us to see these warnings, pray that they'd impact us, that we would recognize how little or how crazy it is for us to have these kinds of pretentious ambitions to make a name for ourselves. When your name is the only one worth making much of. Help us to see that and glory in it, that we would see how great you are, that you would encourage us to see just how amazing you are, that we would recognize our purpose to be reflections of you and your greatness. to reflect your love, your righteousness. That you would motivate us in that way by seeing these expressions of judgment. That we would not be ashamed of them. That we would not be embarrassed by them. That we would recognize that this is your word. We do pray for anyone here who doesn't know you, that they would, through this message, recognize their need to turn from their sin, to turn from their selfish ambitions, to turn from trying to make much of their life, and to find the muchness of life with you. That they would find great joy in the promises that you have for all who take refuge in your Son. Grant us that. Now, as we remember what you've done for us through your Son, pray that you'd strengthen our faith, that you'd help us to remember that the same thing that you've done for us individually is what you've done for this church family. We'd be reminded that we're to care for one another just as you've cared for us, and that we'd look forward to the meal that we're going to have one day with you. You would strengthen our faith, hope, and love through this practice that we carry out. We thank you for giving it to us. Amen.